Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
Most people bring religious traditions to bear on their ethical decisions when, even if they aren't aware of it, they are drawing from something ethical. So maybe you were raised Jewish, but you don't consider yourself religiously Jewish now, but you know, maybe think of yourself as culturally Jewish. These are very slippery concepts here. And so I just think there's a need to study how people connect their faith traditions, even if it's part of like a historic faith tradition, with what they're doing now, and maybe to make that a bit more transparent for people.
Hello, my name is Greg Cuzzona. I'm Executive Director of AI and Faith, and I will be your podcast host today. In fact, today's episode is a conversation with expert Elaine Howard Eklund, sociologist at Rice University, a specialist in the relationship of science, technology, and religion. She also is director of the Boniek Center for Religious Tolerance at Rice. Her research focuses on religion and public life, science and faith, and workplace culture. And the book that I want to talk about today is this book, Working for Better, A New Approach to Faith at Work, which she co-authored with Denise Daniels. And then I've subtly put up a couple of other books that she's written, because she's written a lot, so I couldn't put them all up. But one of those I used, which was in a class I taught on religion, science, and technology. It's a book she co-wrote with Christopher Scheidel on the views of scientists and how they view religion, which will be particularly important, I think, as we look today at this intersection of faith and the workplace and technology. She's also written Religion in a Changing Workplace, and her work has been supported by the National Science Foundation, featured in all kinds of impressive news outlets. She's been a Gifford lecturer. But the thing I actually, as I said, I wanted to begin professionally, but Elaine and I have been friends for quite a number of years now, and I just really enjoy, Elaine, your kindness and your humor. It's something that comes through, and which I appreciate, besides your impressive scholarship. So thank you for being part of our town hall today, our AI and Faith town hall.
Greg, thanks so much for having me, and thanks to the colleagues and new contacts at AI and Faith. I've just really been watching what you're doing with great interest, and I'm excited to be a little bit a part of it today.
This is really wonderful. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the work you've done. You know, you're really known as probably the premier or one of the premier sociologists in our country, but also particularly focusing on this relationship of science and religion. So how did you get into your work, and what particularly interests you about this interaction of technology, society, and faith?
So I started out really like as a kid being interested in science. So I was raised on a farm, so spent a lot of time in the natural world and was in science fairs. And I was that kind of kid. Didn't come from people who had a lot of higher education, but from a family who really encouraged me to be curious about the natural world. I also was raised in what I would call a pretty traditionalist or conservative faith background, which didn't prize higher education in some ways and was even a bit suspicious of it. So I think I carried those background interests with me into my scholarly work. And, you know, many years later, ended up with my husband, who's a particle physicist. And so then got another access set of different kinds of relationships in the science community. And just became really curious about what scientists themselves think about faith and how their own religious traditions, even if they are not religious, the lack of religious tradition has an impact on how they think about science, ethics, their relationship to religion in the world, those kind of things. So fast forward, had a chance to meet Denise Daniels, who is a professor of business and entrepreneurship. She's now at Wheaton College. And Denise and I were part of a leadership convening together on spirituality and faith and how we use spirituality and thinking about leadership. Really got to enjoy each other and became friends. And we thought, gosh, after this seminar ends, we're not going to see each other again. So like, we got to do a research project together. It's like the adult form of a play date, right? For researchers, you're like, let's get together and do research. Will you come over to my house? And we ended up doing research and doing what became the largest study to date of what the U.S. workforce thinks about religion. So going outside my work on scientists to look at occupations more broadly. And then more recently, through my students and actually through my friendship with you, Greg, and with a couple of other friends, have just become super curious about all of the technological changes that are going on in our society. Of course, AI, which is at the forefront of everyone's minds, but also things like this, the massive expansion in gene editing technologies and human reproductive genetic technologies, all of those kinds of technologies which are developing. I've started teaching some about that at Rice, and that's where I am right now.
I'm curious in terms of, you know, the sociological look at this connection, in particular work and religious identification and then technology and science, you know, what just comes out, you know, initially, if there's one surprising element, we'll get a little bit more detailed with your work, but what would be one surprising element that comes out of that?
So we did look at tech workers in our national study. We looked at 15,000 people, so quite a large survey. Tech workers in general, when you put them together in a group, are less religious, generally speaking, than other kinds of workers. And they are also much more international. That when you think about the tech industry broadly, and especially AI creators, you get a very international workforce. And when people migrate, let me just talk about the US for a second. When people migrate to the US, they bring their religious traditions with them, and that has an impact on an occupation. So while it may feel like there are not very many Muslims or Hindus in the US broadly, there, even if you compile those two groups, it's about less than 2%. In certain places in tech industries, it could be 20%. So you could feel like, wow, my occupation is super religiously diverse and I'm getting all this exposure. If you're a person, say, who's a non-religious American, who's a tech worker, getting all this exposure to world religions that maybe I didn't have in my background, and I don't really know how to connect that in the workplace. So there's a kind of religious, I would say non-religion predisposition in tech, but also a religious pluralism that's really interesting. And, you know, we could think about that as well.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. For some reason, this comes back when I think of your other huge study that I was there for when you unveiled it, the RASIC study about religion and science in, you know, in multiple contexts throughout the globe. And one of the images I remember was in India, people doing, you know, a kind of worship with the instruments or a kind of devotional practice, you know. So, you know, I don't know if that happens in Silicon Valley or wherever, but it just shows that what people bring their religious traditions to their work, and part of working in a pluralistic environment, which is very much a part of our, you know, constitution, as it were, as AI and faith, means that we have to understand these different approaches that people take. It's not really a question, and that's an observation, but if you want to comment on it, please do.
Yeah, I'll riff with that. Yeah. Greg's a musician too, so I don't want to have an expansive notion of riff here, just with my words, not with my instruments. But I do think there's maybe more of a need to pay attention to religion in the tech, and I'm saying the tech industry as if this like is a monolith. And I hope the listeners know that I don't view it as a total monolith, but there are certain kinds of common predispositions across tech industries. And we are dealing with major ethical issues in tech industries. And I know some of the folks on this call are, I know from other kinds of networks, and some are new to me. And I'm sure most of you will agree that the kinds of new technology that we're creating, or even if they've been created in the past and they're being more widely used and publicized now, are creating existential questions for people that have lots of practical implications. My colleagues in sociology don't necessarily like it when I say this, but I think it's empirically true. Most people bring religious traditions to bear on their ethical decisions when, even if they aren't aware of it, they are drawing from something ethical. So maybe you were raised Jewish, but you don't consider yourself religiously Jewish now, but you know, maybe think of yourself as culturally Jewish. These are very slippery concepts here. You are, the Jewish tradition has such a rich history of ethical understanding of humanness and things like that, that you're going to bring that to bear kind of naturally, even if you're not totally aware. And so I just think there's a need to study how people connect their faith traditions, even if it's part of like a historic faith tradition, with what they're doing now, and maybe to make that a bit more transparent for people. I'm like kind of stumbling over my language because I know I'm getting into resistant and tricky waters, right? Like these are, you know, things that people are arguing about right now, especially in my particular field in the academy. And we often get super scared when someone says like, yes, have more overt display of religion, right? Like we think neutrality is kind of hiding those things. I don't think that's the case. In fact, I think a more thoughtful understanding and presentation is probably the stance we want to take rather than a feigned neutrality or a secretism. You know, I'm saying something controversial. I recognize that we need lots of debate about this, but sadly right now, I don't think we're even talking about it enough.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is relevant, but it's certainly relevant for me. So I'll just say it, that this whole connection of faith and work is really important to me. It's the earliest thing that I got into as a Christian. So I became a Christian as a young adult at age 18. And then once I left undergrad, I was in a retail business for a while. And I was trying to figure out, as this, you know, burgeoning faith was happening in my life, how to bring that to work. And so some of the first study I did and engagement that both my wife Laura and I did was at New College Berkeley, which had a strong engagement of faith and work. David Gill, who taught for many years at Gordon Conwell, was one of the leading voices there. And then when I started my pastoral ministry at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church, which is so much, you know, New York City is so much about work, I did these interactions between faith and work. And one of my interns was David Miller, who went on then to become the head of the Princeton Faith and Work Initiative. So we were able to gather some really thoughtful, impressive people to talk about this. My whole point being, to me, faith, connecting faith with work, has been a necessity, but also in a way axiomatic. I don't think it's axiomatic for a lot of people, just now speaking as a Christian, within the Christian community. Sometimes that topic of how do we connect our faith with our work has been hidden. And that's why I really appreciate the book that you and Denise have written. First of all, it's so accessible. So it's really great for a large audience working for better, i.e. I'm promoting this book, buy lots of copies, give them out, right? But also,
I have to interrupt and say that's high praise coming in from you, Greg, because you're a writer and probably most of the listeners know. So anyway, that's just high praise coming from you because you're a writer who actually sells copies of your books, right? Which not many academics can say.
Well, I mean, I just appreciate all that you put out there. I mean, I think one of the things you do so well is to make sure people, you don't just hold this research to yourself, but you get it out in various forms, right? And so in this book, as far as my reading of it, you look at different ways that faith and work connect and how people seek to connect them. So I want to make this a broad question because we're not going to get into incredible detail in the book. Can you mention how work is seen from different orientations, you might say, for people of faith?
I think the orientation that makes a big difference is the kind of occupation you're in. And I didn't quite expect that. I thought that, you know, like religious difference would make a huge, have a huge impact on, and we did find that. So we have this other book with Oxford that's Religion in Changing Workplace, where we specifically compare people who are Jewish, Muslim, Christian, and then other groups in smaller numbers. And really, people who are in what we call the professional occupations, where they tend to make more money, they have a lot more autonomy, they're often knowledge workers, have a lot of agency in integrating faith and work. Within that group, people who are higher up in more leadership in their organizations tend to have more agency in connecting their faith and their work. And that makes some sense. We also found that people who are what we might make less, have less agency, very much want to connect their faith and their work. And sometimes And this was both very, very impacting on me as a person and on my co-author as well, I think, when people who are lower income and have less agency in their workplaces are religious people, they often want to connect that to their work, and they do so post hoc. So we used to think like, okay, you feel called by the caller, i.e. a monotheistic God, into a particular occupation. And then you're like, then I was called, and now I'm integrating my faith at work based on this calling. And I'm saying this with a tone that's a little bit facetious, because we didn't really find that to be the case, that people often figure out how to integrate their faith and work after they're already in an occupation, after they're in a job. And I was like, oh my gosh, that causality is really different than I thought it was. So they're coming to terms with how they might integrate their faith and their work later on. I think for those of us who care about integration, which I think integration has lots of practical benefits, and I think it's a good thing. So for multiple reasons, I care about it. There is, I think, a little bit more hope. So for employers who want to see people living as whole people in the workplace, part of which might involve integrating faith and work, there's a sense that people can discover how to do that on the job.
That's really interesting what you found. I mean, that's the great part about to state the incredibly obvious. To actually do the research with 15,000 people and then the several hundred, you know, qualitative interviews you did, is you actually find out some things about how this works instead of the, you know, the assumptions that we might generalize about. And yeah, so these assumptions we might generalize about, of, you know, how we view our faith and our work. And I've got two different directions I want to go, but I'm going to go to this question that I sent you, and then I'll follow it up with something else. So you might call a job, you might call what you do a job, you might call it a career, you might call it a calling. You were touching on calling a minute ago. And I wonder if those different approaches to our work signal something more significant for this connection between faith and work.
I don't think they signal such a significant distinction. So I do think people who end up in, you know, careers, and I would say that in general in the US, we've thought of people who go through higher education as using higher education in part to pursue specific kinds of careers that they get training for in higher education. I don't think higher education is really operating that way anymore. And I think we really notice it now, but there's been a big shift going on, you know, over the past several decades, that people are often going into things that are very different from what they feel that they were trained for, that they switch around a lot, that they are not as loyal to one particular organization as they used to be. So our whole notion of what it means to have a career is really being disrupted. And sociologists and psychologists of work have written lots and lots about this. And I think this has an impact on how we think about the relationship of calling and faith integration broadly to our work, that we have to develop tools and principles that are somewhat nimble, that work with, you know, I'm a college professor, and I've been a college professor quite a long time. I'm living, I think, somewhat atypically for this time, in that I went into this one occupation and I did a couple other things before. I worked in advertising. I worked a little bit in student services. I worked in campus ministry. I kind of like did some things before, but really my entire career so far has been in this one kind of narrow profession. And even within that profession, I've done lots of different types of things, and I've had to think through for myself, you know, what does it mean to integrate my faith with my work when I'm leading a team of 20 people and I'm working more as an administrator versus when I'm primarily a researcher like I was when I was a postdoc versus when there's been times when I've taught a lot of classes and I was primarily a teacher. And so I've even experienced different facets of my job where I've had to be flexible in how I think about integration. And I think other types of people right now are needing to do that in a much deeper and broader way than I have. Does that answer your question, Greg? I think I got doing the professor thing there and giving a little about something, but I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah.
I was like, what exactly were we talking about?
I think it's good. I'm good with that.
I'll go with that.
so that was great. I hear something that interests me as a bit of a specific is, you know, how we actually do our religious practice in work is one aspect of faith and work. And I'll just say that in another podcast I know that you did with Mark Labberton, you talked a lot about the ethics of work, and that's, and you know, representation and those issues as well. So there's a lot of different angles that faith and work can take. But I want to look at that more religious practice side. And I know in my own life, when I was owning my retail business, when I had my office as an academic, California State University, Chico for 12 years, I would often pray in those environments as a way of, you might say, sacralizing that environment, so that I would see this as part of where I was bringing my faith in God to this environment. In the book, you mentioned that in some ways, the Muslim five times daily praying is a way of, you know, creating space to bring in that connection with God. And then I know Denise has worked a lot with the notion of Sabbath in her life. And, you know, that's something that's really affected me. And we've talked a lot about that, you know, over the years. And then I know from another book that you have this practice you mentioned of walking to campus and the different places that are reminders of God's presence for you in your work as an academic. So I guess in that is, those are reflections on ways that people actually practice their religious devotion in the workplace. You're welcome to comment on anything that you personally do, but also, are there any things that you observed in your research as far as personal practice of religious faith?
I will say as a caveat that employers are really afraid of being sued. They're really afraid of workplace harassment, and I think under certain conditions for good reason. And so they bring those kind of fears to this whole faith at work discussion. So when we interview employers, they are very afraid that evangelical Christians are out there just like hammering people with the Christian gospel. I mean, and I would say that if you are an evangelical pastor and you think that's a good idea, you're going to be pretty darn disappointed. Like, there's a lot less of that going on than workplace leaders fear. It is going on in some places. And even when it does go on, it's usually done in a way that is not as, like, you know, we used to use the phrase like beating people over the head with the Bible. Like, it's not done that way. It's more, I remember one particular case, which was somewhat typical, where so this person we surveyed, we had this nice research design where we could link what people said in the survey, and then we could interview them and follow up on things because we could match those IDs. And we were interviewing someone who'd said that they talked about their faith a lot at work and identified as an evangelical Christian. And uncommon, we had the opportunity to also interview someone in that same workplace. That didn't often happen. But so we interviewed someone who's an evangelical Christian and someone who's a Muslim in the workplace. And the person who said that they talk about their faith a lot at work, what they did when we interviewed them is they actually held like a lunchtime group that was really what I would call more about religious pluralism. So the lunchtime group had an evangelical Christian, someone identified as non-religious, and a woman who identified, so the evangelical Christian was a man who's non-religious, and a woman who's Muslim who covered. And we interviewed her as well. And she talked like in glowing terms about this like fun lunchtime conversation that the three of them had about the differences among their religious traditions, or you know, how the non-religious person saw ethics and these kinds of things. So they were like sort of investigating each other's perspectives. Now, this is a little bit Pollyanna-ish, like this is going to be probably pretty uncommon, although I don't know. I mean, I would like to study this more deeply to find out how often these kind of workplace groups take place. And, you know, we're raising funding now to do other kinds of studies where we would actually get into organizations. Those kinds of studies are hard to do because of human subjects and legal structures that corporations have. So that's the kind of thing that workplace leaders are afraid of. Here's what happens sometimes. It's quite different than what workplace leaders think. And then thirdly, I would say that just from a personal story, I have been so influenced, I guess, by my students. I have the privilege now of working with more than 20 PhD students and postdoctoral fellows. And this is humbling, right? Some of them have tenure now, which says then some things about how old I am, right? But I had several Muslim students and colleagues, and one recently, her qualifying exams, for those of you who don't know academia, the qualifying exams are one of the most grueling things on the way to get a PhD in our department. It's, you know, over 3 days. The students have to do writing for 8 hours without any sources, and then they do an oral exam for 2 or 3 hours where they're asked questions about their written exam by a group of faculty. And this student who's Muslim was, my student was going through Ramadan at the same time and was fasting all day. And I said, you know, I will totally go to bat for you and get the delay for you so you don't have to take the exam during Ramadan. And she said, no, I really think this is part of my worship. It kind of makes me tingly to tell the story. And I think that God will provide for me and I will learn something from doing this during Ramadan. And she did amazing. Even if she hadn't, it would have been a type of testimony, if that makes sense.
Right.
She got one of the highest grades that we've ever given in the department. And it had a huge impact on me personally. It just taught me a lot about faithfulness and trust and religious difference and confronting authority. And I mean, it took guts for her to confront me and talk to me about this so openly. And she, you know, was aware that I've done some public Christian writing. And so I think she's aware of my own faith tradition. So there was a lot going on there. And I was so proud of her. And it just taught me so much.
That's amazing. Yeah. And sometimes, it, you know, when we bring our faith to work, let's put it another way, if it's really integrated with who we are, we have to bring it. You know, it's like that's part of who we are, or we're not going to perform. We're not bringing all we can to our work. I wanted to make sure we pivoted a little bit to the tech and AI sector. Sure. So, you know, you've studied religious discrimination in the workplace. And I want to know if you think the tech sector has any particular culture that gives some specific contours to what religious discrimination might look like.
I just want to be honest about what data I'm speaking from. So I'm kind of a scholar at heart here. So I would say my AI and faith work, I learned most of what I know from my student, Dee Dee. I have her book right here, which is called Divine Meets Digital Tech Workers and Religion in the U.S. and China.
And her name is DD, right? Yeah, D-I-D-I,
exactly,
right? So
yeah.
That's not just her first name. That's her
name. No, that's her
name,
whole
right?
Name. It's a Chinese name. And she is now an associate professor. She has just got tenure at Santa Clara University. So that's really fun to have a student doing that kind of important work. So from our Faith at Work study, we found tech workers to be somewhat distinctive. On the whole, they do not report being part of traditional religion very much. They are like on the very low end of all occupations. So to give you a sense, like people who work in the agriculture sector and manufacturing and people who work in service work, especially in relational service work, like providing home health care, tend to be on the upper end of traditional, if we think of traditional religious, like people who say that they do a lot of religious practices, identify and are part of religious organizations is my definition. Tech workers are quite low on all of that. And yet, tech is also an industry where there's a lot of religious diversity because it's a very international industry. So I suspect that there's a bit of self-selection where the less religious people from sending nations are coming, given what we see in terms of the demographics, the religious demographics of the tech industry in the U.S., but there's still more religious diversity because there's more South Asians, East Asians in the tech industry than there are in other industries. And the dominant religions in those nations tend to not be Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so you might feel like, oh my gosh, the U.S. is a Christian nation, or the tech industry is predominantly non-religious. Both of those things are to some extent true, but you will find a lot of religious diversity that needs to be dealt with in the tech industry. And I think that makes it kind of unique. There is also, I would say, thirdly, it's a pretty male industry. I think there is more diversity in certain subfields within tech. And we know in general in the world, women tend to be a bit more religious than men, although there are some signs that that's shifting a bit. It is an industry where there's like rapid growth in some sectors and decline in others. So it's like this like up down kind of industry, which can have an impact on how people think about existential things. It's an industry where there is rapidly shifting kinds of products and outputs, and there is like mass commercial impact, and there is a need to reflect ethically. We usually think of ethical reflection as a somewhat slow process. So our ethics are not speedy. The development of new ethical systems is not this a speedy process. It is a slow process, which is to some extent antagonistic. That's a little bit of a negative word, but it's sometimes accurate to the kind of speed which is inherent in the tech industry. Mm-hmm. It's also an industry which is in some quarters. I say this very sensitively because I know some of the folks on this call who are doing the deep ethical reflection that needs to be done and are very concerned about these issues and are real leaders in that area. But it is an industry which can be very dehumanizing to people. Mm. And so that's all there. All of the things that I just said, which have an impact on, you know, how we think about caring for workers who are in tech, both those in the U.S. and those who support tech outside the U.S., how we think about transmitting to broader publics, and how we think about ethical systems, which have an impact on both of those things.
Are there particular aspects of connecting work and artificial intelligence, people who are in artificial intelligence? And I'm gonna give a little bit more to this question of my own background as well. You know, I grew up in the Silicon Valley, and my experience of the Silicon Valley has been that it is dominantly secular, and by which I mean there's not a desire to find something transcendent. In fact, the whole ethos is one of we can solve problems through our technological or scientific insights or whatever management insights we have. Now, here's my little pullout. I was really fascinated by this report that the American Bible Society came out with. They did this State of the Bible report, and they looked at the Silicon Valley. And this came out of a conversation I was having with their key person in charge of this work, John Plake. And he said, if you remove my demographic, I'm you know, a sort of youngish baby boomer. If you remove my demographic from the Silicon Valley, we tend to be baked in our views about the Bible. But if you take them out, the rest of the Silicon Valley actually looks a lot like the rest of the United States, at least in terms of its view of the Bible. And so I found that really a fascinating something to continue to pursue, what that would mean for my general assumption and experience that the Silicon Valley tends to be secular in its mindset. So here's my question to help us with our work at AI and Faith. What would a faith-literate AI ethics framework look like, given your research, compared to the more secularly dominated frameworks that are part of the tech and AI industry?
Just a couple of thoughts. So Carolyn Chen has written an interesting book. She's at Berkeley, about faith in the tech industry. And she centers a lot on spirituality. Like if you read the book, she got, you know, some of these ideas to study this population and through her own yoga practice and things like that. And so she argues that there's a lot of spirituality in the tech industry. And my former student and now colleague, Didi, argues similarly, although she brings in this really great international perspective. I'm going to claim, though, that most ethical reflection doesn't come from what we would think of as the spiritual impulse, which is in the U.S. tends to be pretty sociosyncretic, meaning that it picks and chooses from a lot of different types of religious traditions and non-religion. I'm not saying that people who are spiritual aren't ethical. Like, please don't accuse me of saying that. But what I am saying is that most of the world's religious traditions have more cohesive ethical frameworks and have more possibility to contribute to ethical reflection than does a broad spiritual impulse. The reason I think that people want to focus so much on spirituality is one of the reasons is because it seems quite neutral. It doesn't demand accommodations necessarily. There's not a lot of demands placed on it. And it can definitely, I know from my own work, contribute to health and things like that. So I'm not saying that those things aren't true. But when we're just talking about ethical reflection, I think we need to get into the world's religious traditions and try to figure out how some of the ethical strains which are in these traditions might apply in terms of helping us frame new technologies and their impact on things like personhood and humanness. So, Greg, I think you and your colleagues at Faith and AI can do a lot here. You know, that it just, you can be real pioneers because that work is not being done. And remember that I said, you know, people within tech tend to not be traditionally religious. I have not done ethnography in those organizations. So it's probably the case, if the industry looks not religious, that even if you are religious in the industry, you don't feel like you can speak openly about it, that there's a kind of cultural non-religion that's happening. That would be my hypothesis, again, not having done actual work there. So I do think that we face potentially an uphill battle, right? That there's not, it's not as if leaders are saying like, oh my gosh, like where are the people with religious traditions? Let me listen to them. That there's not this demand for a traditional religion. And so then as, you know, a researcher, I want to know, like, how can we create that demand? Is what I just said true about people drawing from their ethical, from the religious traditions for their ethics, even if they're not currently practicing the tradition? Is that true among tech workers? Is there like a sort of more covert demand? I suspect that there is, from what my colleagues who've done like ethnographic studies in tech organizations and interviews with workers are finding. Push though, Greg, is there something else you want to ask?
Well, I'll just actually speak from an experience that I had about a week and a half ago. So I was invited with 14 other Christian scholars to Anthropic to engage with their AI model agent, Claude, and the Claude Constitution. We spent a day and a half with at least five people from Anthropic, you know, at all levels of the company. And because it was mainly theological and religious, well, it was all Christian scholars. So in addition to philosophers, ethicists, and theologians, there weren't a lot of technical experts in this particular conversation. So we learned about AI, you know, what it is, some of the complexities of AI models, and that Anthropic itself, you know, doesn't always understand why Claude is behaving the way it is. But the point of what I'm saying is they were particularly looking at input from multiple religious voices, but in this case, it was a Christian gathering, on ethics and wisdom and how that might inform, you know, the next part of the training of Claude, et cetera. What was a fantastic statement that came out that, you know, as a theologian, I had to record was, here's the point where theology becomes shockingly relevant. I just love that. You know, like there is a degree to which, at least in this conversation with the, you know, Frontier Lab, where they were saying we need something from traditional religious voices to help us understand how to frame some of the ethical questions that are emerging. We got a chance to meet some of the employees in one of the breaks who are Christians at Anthropic. I'm just, again, this was a Christian group, but there's going to be other groups at Anthropic meeting from multiple religious traditions. But we did meet a Christian group that meets at Anthropic. And is this the case of religious people banding together? That's how the question was framed, which I would add, is there a certain way that helps the voice, the pluralism, that's the religious pluralism in a company to be represented and to be articulated?
That's a good question. I do know of those, and they call them ERGs, right? Employee resource groups that are present at some of those places. I've spoken at a couple of them, and my colleague Denise Daniels has spoken at others. Denise, by the way, does a video series, which is very good, called Faith and Co., where she speaks to some members of different industries about integration of faith at work, if anyone's interested in that. I wonder if there's benefit in getting together with members of one's own tradition and hashing out some of the ethical issues from the point of view of your tradition first and before entering into more plural kinds of gatherings. The reason I say that is because we're doing a lot of religious literacy training in the Banyak Institute for the Study and Advancement of Religious Tolerance, which is an institute I lead at Rice University. And we're finding that people often don't know their own traditions very well, that they haven't really used their own traditions to think through ethical issues, and that actually there's a lot more comfort and ease in cross-religious gatherings when you first understand your own tradition. So I wonder if, especially, we're asking people, when it comes to faith and AI and ethics, we're asking people to do really hard, deep work about new things. And so it seems like the need to first reflect from the point of view of one's own tradition is maybe even more important. Now, I can't say, is that kind of reflection, does that best happen, say, from your synagogue versus your workplace with other people in your same occupation, but who might come from, you know, in the case of Judaism, you know, a range of different types of traditions within Judaism? I don't know. I don't know really the answer to that question, but my sense is that it's best to first interact with those from your own tradition around these issues, and then to go into pluralistic kinds of environments. And I do think the pluralism is really important.
Yeah. And I wonder, I'd be interested to know if there's a competitive advantage that companies who would be more inviting of religious diversity, if that would be seen as something that's a value for the company.
We find that that's true with other industries. I don't think we have a large enough people in tech within our study to make that kind of claim about tech. But we do find that that's the case in manufacturing and some other industries, where when people are allowed to bring their faith to work, that they tend to be more committed to the organization, want to stay long term, say that they think more about other people in the organization. They have just a lot. So there is that impulse to be loyal to the organization that allows you to bring your faith and other aspects of your whole self into the workplace.
That's fascinating. Yeah, thank you. I have on my little sheet here, any final thoughts from the speaker? So is there anything from the speaker that you'd like to say before we wrap up?
We sometimes think that AI, you know, people in my age group, I'm safely middle-aged, think that new technologies are something for younger generations. And I have, you know, seen my students at Rice University struggle so much with the ethical implications of new technologies. And they resist now when I say, you know, you're the leaders of the future. You need to figure out what's going to happen here, as if by me saying that, I'm abdicating myself from this role. So I've stopped saying those kinds of things. And I think now we're all in it together. And sometimes people in my age group can be incredibly insecure because we are not as quick. We're not digital natives, as my daughter will tell me over and over again. But we do have something to add. And these things are affecting everyone, just the rapid creation of technology, and we need all hands on deck across all generations and across all experience levels to move forward wisely. And we need to bring our faith traditions to bear. I think that's incredibly important. The world's traditions have a lot to add, and sadly, I think they're being ignored at a time when they're most needed.
That's a great wrap up. Thank you for that, Elaine. I appreciate who you are in this work. I appreciate, if I may, on a personal note, your friendship over the years. And I appreciate your talking with us at AI and Faith.
Thank you so much. This is a real all-star group who's gathered. Some of you are leading incredible efforts. So just thank you so much for having me, Greg. And I really appreciate you so much.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.